Every year, tens of thousands of shorebirds called red knots make an enormous journey. They travel nearly the entire span between the South Pole and the North Pole. But changes in climate along the bird's route are putting the species at risk, so much so that the federal government believes this remarkable bird is threatened with extinction. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren explains why.
Every year, thousands of red knots stop at beaches along the Delaware Bay to feed as they fly north. A crew of biologists led by Kevin Kalis has set a trap for them.
3, 2, 1, fire.
Explosives launch a huge net. It falls on hundreds of birds and traps them. About a dozen people pop out of hiding places in a marsh and dash to collect the birds.
We have a knot box.
They're moaning.
They sound so pitiful.
These biologists and volunteers are catching the birds to monitor their health. Red knot numbers are down by about three quarters since the 1980s. These birds are on their way to the Arctic from the bottom of South America, 9,300 miles. They stop here because they're starving. Kalis holds a robin-sized bird with a long bill and cinnamon-colored breast.
So this red knot, very skinny. I can feel almost its entire breastbone. I feel right there.
Oh my goodness, it's so skinny. There's no meat on its bones.
There's no meat, yeah.
They come here because this is where a strange prehistoric-looking animal called the horseshoe crab comes to lay its eggs. More spawn here than anywhere else in the world.
I mean, there isn't anything better for these birds to eat. These little tiny horseshoe crab eggs are just packed full of fat.
The red knot's migration is an exquisitely timed act of nature. The crabs and the birds have to arrive at the same time if the birds are going to get enough to eat. But biologists worry a changing climate could throw this rendezvous out of sync. Warming water temperatures could trigger the crabs to lay eggs before the birds arrive. What's more, rising seas and bigger storms are washing away the beaches. And Wendy Walsh from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the danger doesn't stop here.
Climate change threat to the red knot is one that's throughout its range,
including the Arctic, where it nests.
Warming in the Arctic, we know, is proceeding faster than most other parts of the globe.
The Fish and Wildlife Service can't do much about the Arctic. What it can do is protect the bird along the East Coast, in places, for example, like North Carolina's Outer Banks, a strip of low-lying islands. That's where some of the birds stop or even stay for the winter. Warren Judge chairs a local county commission on the Outer Banks. He says the beaches already get closed to protect other rare shore birds.
The red knot is just another bird that can land someplace and create another closure. Our tourism is based upon the beach. It's very hard on the economy.
He says every time they close a beach, they're closing a great place to fish, surf, or play. The Fish and Wildlife Service's Wendy Walsh says it's true. If the red knot goes on the endangered species list, beaches could be closed briefly every year. And that's not all. Her agency could discourage communities from doing things such as building seawalls.
This is totally understandable why humans would do this when they have valuable infrastructure and property and lives at stake behind the walls. But that is a threat to the red knot going forward.
Biologists say other animals, from polar bears to butterflies, face similar dilemmas. Climate change is altering their environment. The government is expected to act on the red knot in late September. That's when the birds will be making their fall migration from the top of the globe back to the bottom. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
There is a silent killer sweeping through Central America these days, and it has nothing to do with drug cartels or gang violence. It's a plant fungus known as coffee rust, or roya in Spanish. It's destroying the region's highly coveted coffee crop, causing more than $1 billion in losses and leaving hundreds of thousands unemployed. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Outside the northern Guatemalan town of Alopa, near the Honduran border, farmer Edwin Fernando Diaz Vieira stands in the middle of his tiny coffee field. He says it was his lifelong dream to own a farm here. So 10 years ago, he left for Guatemala's capital, worked the night shift at a gas station for 6 years, and came back home to plant coffee.
Bonita mi finca, esto era una finca grande.
My farm was beautiful. It was big. But 2 years after I got back, coffee rust appeared and wiped out everything.
That was 2012, and it was his first crop. The rust took it all. The fungus roared over the hillsides, covered the valleys, and clung to the slopes of Guatemala's shady volcanoes, renowned for producing some of the world's richest Arabica, the smooth-tasting beans beloved by specialty coffee brewers.
Una bomba atómica que devastó todo.
Diaz says it was like an atomic bomb went off, wiped the whole place clean. In El Salvador, nearly three-quarters of all trees are infected with the fungus. In Costa Rica, more than 60%. And in Guatemala, coffee rust covers 70% of all trees, costing at least 100,000 jobs and a 15% drop in coffee output in just the last 2 years. Francisco Anzueto of Guatemala's coffee board, Ana Café, says coffee rust long has been in the region, but recently it became more aggressive.
Clima, incremento de temperatura.
It's climate change, he says. Temperatures are up, and the fungus thrives in the heat, attacking the leaves of coffee trees, eventually choking off nutrients to the cherries that encase the beans. Most distressing is now it's hotter in the higher altitudes, where rust rarely ventured, and Guatemala's finest beans are grown. That got several producers, including Starbucks and Green Mountain, to team up with USAID. They've pooled more than $23 million to offer financing to repair crops and train farmers to fight the disease. I asked Mark Visaki, who heads USAID in Guatemala, if that's enough money.
No, it's a big problem. And if it's not crisis, it's very close to crisis.
Visaki says it will be a crisis when coffee prices spike and illegal immigration to the U.S. rises. Coffee prices are up, but mostly due to the prolonged drought in Brazil. And humanitarian organizations insist the current flood of immigrants out of Central America is not a product of rust-induced unemployment. But ask around Alopa by the Honduran border and you get a different answer. One farmer estimated that a third of the tiny town's residents are in the U.S. Jose Ramirez Mendez's house is guarded by a very skinny mud. His crop was wiped out 2 years ago by the fungus, and both he and his younger brother took off for the U.S. He got caught in Arizona and deported back.
Lo que tengo sembrado no es la misma clase de lo que estaba.
He says now he planted a new coffee variety that is supposedly resistant to rust. His brother sends money when he can, but the family is deep in debt from the smuggler and the previously failed crop. Many farmers are turning to the new resistant plants, but the coffee quality is said to not be as good. Or they're pruning back trees with hope that new growth will improve resistance. Then there are others just getting out of the coffee business altogether. Humberto Mendez Perez digs a shallow hole, grabs a few black beans from a plastic cup, and tosses them in. He and his 7-year-old son and 10-year-old nephew do this repeatedly up a steep hillside. He lost his crop to rust last year and has to plant corn and beans if his extended family is to survive. Daniel McQuillan is an agricultural specialist with the charity CRS Catholic Relief Services.
It's really a nightmare from an environmental perspective.
His group is trying to help coffee farmers stay in the business. They give them vegetable seeds and fruit trees that also provide shade and some protection from rust to try and diversify their incomes. And they give them loans for bigger projects. Edwin Diaz bought 100 chickens with an $800 loan from CRS. His eggs are selling like crazy. He can't keep up with demand. Once he pays off the loan, the money then goes to another farmer.
Yo ahorita no, ya no quiero irme solo al café.
He says he doesn't want to depend solely on coffee anymore. He, too, has planted the rust-resistant strain of coffee, but he doesn't like the lower quality. Diaz takes me over to two small plants set aside. He says that's all that remains of his fine Arabica trees. He saved them just in case one day rust is gone from Guatemala, so he'll have a supply of good seeds.
Ponerlo en un museo.
If that day doesn't come, he jokes, he'll donate the plants to a museum so people will have some way to remember Guatemala's once fine coffee. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
Some say that hockey is at risk. Not another lockout, but warming climate. Lots of children from Stillwater to Saskatchewan to Stockholm first learned to play the game on a frozen pond. But what if the temperatures didn't drop low enough and those freshwater ponds didn't freeze? Those are some of the concerns in a sustainability report that was recently put out by the National Hockey League. The report looks at how climate change and other environmental factors could affect the sport and what the league might do to help. We are joined now by the commissioner of the National Hockey League, Gary Bettman, joining us from his offices in Manhattan. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, it's good to be with you, Scott. This is an important topic, not just for hockey fans, but for everybody.
Now, we're not just talking about solar-powered Zambonis here, are we?
No, we're not. What we're really talking about from our standpoint is two things. Is one, what from a business standpoint are our practices that we can do better and in a way that's more sustainable for the environment? And it can be recycling. It can also be taking food that has been untouched and unused and not sending it to a dump, but instead using it for food for people that might need it as well. Mm-hmm. It could be travel practices. It can be solar panels. But the second aspect of all of this is I think sports is a great platform to raise consciousness on important issues. Mm.
I mean, it's a pretty, and maybe every major sport is, but you've got to freeze the arena. You got to unfreeze it if they're playing basketball the next night. You've got to fly between various locations. I mean, this is a lot of energy, isn't it?
It is a lot of energy, and it's a lot of energy of lots of people traveling to come to our events. What sets us apart a little bit, and maybe it gets romanticized, is the notion of frozen ponds. And so for us, it's even more important that we have predictable, sensible, reliable climate and that the ponds continue to freeze and we have winter where we're supposed to have winter so that people can enjoy our sport not only when it's played at the NHL level in an arena, but children learning to play on frozen ponds, learning to skate on frozen ponds. Hmm.
Have you done some stuff already? I know that there was this the Green Initiative in 2010 that you undertook with the National Resources Defense Council.
We are the first sports league to do a sustainability report to see if we can come up with best practices for our clubs and our league office to use and our arenas to use, but at the same time make people aware of the importance of these efforts. Mm.
The Commissioner of the National Hockey League, Gary Bettman, thanks very much, sir.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And now a story about an extremely rare albino tree. If you pass it on the street, it might look dead. It's not dead. It was almost killed, but now it's going to survive, thanks in part to this guy.
My name is Zane Moore. I'm an undergraduate botany student at Colorado State University, and I'm studying chlorophyll-deficient redwoods.
In other words, albino redwoods.
In other words, albino redwoods, yes.
One of which is growing not too far from you.
Yeah, there's an albino redwood growing about 45 minutes north of San Francisco in a little town called Cotati. And it is the tallest albino redwood we know about. And it's also really special because it's a chimera. Two different sets of DNA, two genetic individuals that are inside one bud or one meristem of a plant.
And does that make this tree kind of half albino and half not?
Yes, that makes this tree half albino and half normal green redwood.
Explain how rare a tree like this is.
Okay, well, a tree like this, a chimera, is extremely rare. We don't know of only about 10 chimeras in the redwood species.
When you say 10 per species, you mean there may be thousands and thousands of redwood trees out there. There are a total of 10 like this one.
Yes, millions, really. There are millions of acres of redwood forest in California. There are only 10 of these trees known.
Wow.
So extremely rare.
It was originally going to be cut down to make way for a set of railroad tracks, and I understand now it's just going to be moved. How difficult is it to move a great big redwood tree, let alone an albino one?
It can be a pretty hefty task to move one of these trees. The tree is 52 feet tall. And has a pretty nice crown spread of probably about 30 feet. So that means that its root spread is at least 30 feet out away from the base of the tree. In order to move a tree, they have to dig a hole around this entire root system and lift the tree up. And then what they're planning on doing is making tracks to slide the tree over across the street and in a safer location.
Okay, so explain how this albino redwood became a national celebrity.
Tom Stapleton, an arborist who I'm working with, and I found out that this tree was due to be cut down at the beginning of April. So we immediately went to the media, to the local paper, the Press Democrat, out of Sonoma County. And immediately, within a few hours that day, the story went national and even international to some places in the UK also.
What could scientists learn from studying a tree like this?
Well, studying albino plants can be, for one, really interesting because albino plants produce very limited amounts of chlorophyll, the molecule that allows plants to photosynthesize. If scientists can better understand what allows a plant to make chlorophyll and what allows a plant like an albino not to make chlorophyll, we might be able to make better photovoltaic solar cells and potentially make better, more efficient, sustainable energy for the future by learning more about how plants take the sun and make it into everything that we use today, like food, oxygen, wood.
That's Zane Moore, a student botanist at Colorado State University, speaking with us from San Jose, California. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
At this moment, in a windowless laboratory in downtown Baltimore, some tiny translucent fish larvae are swimming around in glass-walled tanks. They are baby bluefin tuna. Scientists there are trying to grasp what they call the holy grail of aquaculture, raising this powerful fish, so prized by sushi lovers, entirely in captivity. They're reporting successes, but many hurdles remain. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
I couldn't see the larvae at first. Yoni Zohar, the scientist in charge of this project, had to point them out to me.
Here you can look. They are very hard to see. They are like small speckles in the water, but you see them beautifully here swimming.
They look incredibly fragile and helpless, just drifting in the water currents in 90-gallon tanks. But they're already gobbling up microscopic marine animals, which in turn are living on algae.
I mean, it's amazing. We cannot stop looking at them. I mean, we're really sitting here around the clock, and we're looking at them because it's so beautiful.
Beautiful because they're rare. Scientists are trying to raise bluefin tuna completely in captivity in just a few places around the world. This experiment at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Institute of Marine and Environmental Technology is the first successful attempt in North America. At least it's a little bit successful. Most of the larvae have died, but hundreds have survived for 10 days.
And we're counting every day. We want to be at like 25 to 30 days.
Because this is the time when they typically don't survive?
This is the bottleneck. You know, the bottleneck is the first 3 to 4 weeks.
If they make it, they'll be juvenile fish and much more sturdy. What they need then is lots to eat. Fully grown, the bluefin tuna is a tiger of the ocean, powerful and voracious. Its flesh is in high demand for sushi all around the world. Journalist Paul Greenberg wrote about the bluefin tuna in his book, Four Fish. He says if you're an angler, catching one is an experience you don't forget.
When they come on board, it's just this, it's like raw energy coming onto the boat. Their tail will go bop, 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 bop. It's like this outboard engine that's just blazing with power and energy.
The fish can swim 45 miles an hour across entire oceans, and they're valuable. Demand for them has grown, especially in Japan, where people sometimes pay fantastic prices for them. It's led to overfishing, and now wild populations of tuna are declining. That's why scientists like Yoni Zohar are trying to invent a new way to supply the world's demand, bluefin tuna farming.
The vision is to have huge tanks, you know, land-based in a facility like what you see here, having bluefin tuna that are spawning year-round on demand, producing millions of eggs.
And those eggs would hatch and grow into full-grown fish, a plentiful supply of tuna. Which brings us back to these precious larvae. Before there can be aquaculture, these larvae have to survive. Here in the laboratory, they're tinkering with lots of things to make that possible. The lights above the tanks, the concentration of algae, water currents to keep the fragile larvae from sinking toward the bottom of the tank.
They tend to go down. They have heavy head. They go head down and tail up. If they go to the bottom, they hit their head on the bottom, they're gone. They're not going to survive.
Enough are surviving that Zohar thinks they're getting close to overcoming this obstacle. But that still leaves a final hurdle, figuring out how to satisfy the tuna's amazing appetite without causing even more damage to the environment. A tuna's natural diet is other fish, a lot of them. Right now, you have to feed tuna something like 15 pounds of fish like sardines or mackerel to gain a pound of consumable tuna. So you could cause a lot of damage to those species to keep the farmed tuna alive. Yoni Zohar thinks it will be possible to reduce this ratio or create non-fishy tuna food. But Paul Greenberg, the journalist, says this basic fact about tuna really does make him wonder whether tuna farming is the right way to go. You'd be increasing the population of a predator species that demands lots of food itself.
I mean, why would you want to domesticate a tiger when you could domesticate a cow?
Or even better, a chicken, which turns just 2 pounds of vegetarian feed into a pound of meat. Greenberg says if farmed tuna really reduces the demand for tuna caught in the wild, that's good. But it might do more good, he says, to eat a little lower on the marine food chain. We could eat more mussels or sardines. Let more tuna roam free. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Until very recently, earthquakes in Oklahoma were unheard of. But this year, the state has seen more tremors than California. Why is that? It's a subject of debate. Some scientists point to the way the oil and gas industry disposes of wastewater, a byproduct of drilling, and of the process called fracking. Earlier this month, a study published in the journal Science found what it called a clear link between wastewater wells and earthquakes. But many gas companies and state regulators disagree. They claim it's too soon to say. We turn to energy reporter Joe Wirtz of State Impact Oklahoma for an update on the controversy. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the study, could we have just a little bit of background here, Joe? What are these disposal wells that we're talking about?
Well, when you drill for oil and gas, you get a lot of wastewater. When the oil and gas comes to the surface, it brings a lot of wastewater with it. And oil and gas companies need to pump that wastewater thousands of feet underground to lock it under layers of rock to keep it away from the water table. Oklahoma has more than 10,000 of these disposal wells.
Okay, then let's get back to the study, which was done by Katie Karanen. She's a research seismologist at Cornell University. She looked at an area experiencing a lot of quakes, very near where you are, Joe, the town of Jones, a small town just northeast of Oklahoma City. Tell us what you found.
Well, more than 2,500 earthquakes have shaken this area since 2008, which accounts for about 20% of the quakes in the middle of the United States. Most of these disposal wells don't cause quakes, but the earthquakes near Jones could have been caused by a handful of high-volume wells, where millions of barrels of water are pumped every month. What Kiernan found is twofold. First, she found that wastewater pumped into the ground can travel a lot farther than initially thought, and that it builds up pressure all along the way on its path. And this pressure can cause fault lines to slip and trigger an earthquake.
Does anybody regulate these wells?
There's a little regulation when it comes to earthquakes. In Oklahoma, oil and gas officials have stiffened monitoring requirements for certain disposal well operators.
So, presumably, if there's an earthquake, they will notice that it happened.
Right, and they hope that the extra data that they'll get from this monitoring will help them identify the warning signs to prevent them in the future. They also have a process to evaluate the risks and shut down a well if they think it's causing quakes, and they're no longer rubber stamping disposal well permits in earthquake-prone areas. Other states, however, have been more aggressive with regulation. It's important to remember, though, that most of Oklahoma's quakes are small. And these disposal wells are a key part of the oil and gas industry, and you really can't drill without them.
And Oklahoma lives and dies by oil and gas.
They sure do, and it's Oklahomans are generally very accepting of the oil and gas industry, and it's a low-regulation state. They're very tolerant of this stuff, so we're kind of in a weird area. There's a lot of people, you know, who are impacted by the earthquakes that also work in the oil and gas industry, so we're put in a precarious situation between this phenomenon that's happening and an industry that we'd like to preserve and promote.
Joe Wirtz is an energy reporter for State Impact Oklahoma. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.